oxide production. Rod?
Thanks very much, Brian. I'm a soil scientist with ARS in St. Paul, also co-located at the University of Minnesota. My colleagues, Carl Rosen, Bijesh Maharjan, postdoc Ryo Fujinuma. And I'd like to acknowledge the funding sources and also John Deere, who provided some of the equipment for this field study that I'll be talking about. So what I'm going to try to do here, just a couple of things, review some of our recent, and in some cases not so recent, field studies of N2O emissions in agricultural cropping systems to try to take a look at how fertilizer management practices, some of the things we've heard about in the previous two talks, such as placement, source, and other factors, can affect some of the underlying processes that drive N2O emissions, and then discuss what these results imply with regard to both to developing improved models and challenges for developing effective mitigation strategies. First point I want to make is something I think that just is reinforcing what Cliff has said, that there are actually hundreds of studies measuring N2O emissions in agricultural systems, but if you try to find studies that have done side-by-side comparisons of fertilizer management practices in the same system at the same time, they're surprisingly low numbers. And I've listed a few of the categories and subcategories here. Some of them are quite surprising. For example, if you look at fall versus spring applied fertilizer, two studies that I could find. Of course, you're never quite sure. You've got all the studies. Anhydrous ammonia placement depth, one study. Anhydrous ammonia versus other sources, three studies. So obviously the reason these types of studies are so important is because those are the kinds of experiments that are going to tell us if specific management practices, other than reducing the N rate, are going to be effective mitigation strategies. And to see if the effectiveness of these strategies is going to vary by cropping system, climate, from one year to the next, et cetera, and then can we take that information, develop models of whatever type, either an emission factor-based model or a process-oriented model, so that we can then predict how a change from one practice to another is going to affect N2O emissions. So I guess to just put it another way, what we need is a better understanding of how these management practices are going to interact with each other and interact with soil and climate factors to affect the underlying processes that affect N2O emissions, and then incorporate that understanding into improved models. So going back to the list there, the studies that I'm going to talk about have addressed these three issues: comparisons of anhydrous ammonia and broadcast urea, in particular in a coarse textured soil. And within that same study, we looked at effects of application depth of the anhydrous ammonia. And in a separate experiment in a silt loam soil, we compared broadcast versus band-applied urea. So anhydrous ammonia are two of the dominant players in North America anyway. Data from 2008 for the U.S. as a whole, together they account for about 60% of the total use. We did a recent survey of corn growers in Minnesota. In that case, it's more than 90% of the total fertilizer is equally shared between anhydrous ammonia and urea. And despite those statistics, as I said, there's been very few studies looking at those comparisons. So we have done some previous work on this in a silt loam soil, and we found reduced N2O emissions with broadcast urea. We also looked at that under varying tillage and crop rotation. So one thing we wanted to do was just look at this in a different soil type. There are some very coarse textured soils in central Minnesota that are used for both corn and potato production with irrigation. And so we did a two-year study with these three different treatments: urea that was broadcast and incorporated, anhydrous ammonia injected at the conventional depth, which is about 20 centimeters, and that at a shallower depth using some new equipment that John Deere has recently commercialized. All sources were applied in two split applications, half before planting and half a few weeks later. Total application rate was 180 kilograms per hectare. So I'm not going to go through all the details of the data. This is just summarizing the two-year mean growing season emissions. And you can see the significant differences between all three treatments. In the shallow anhydrous treatment had more than the conventional, which had more than the broadcast urea. So if we put that data back together with our other study results, we have six site years of results now, and each site year has several different systems that we looked at, and the percent reductions ranging from 30 to 80% with broadcast urea compared to anhydrous ammonia. So why are we getting greater emissions with anhydrous ammonia than urea? Is a question I'm going to talk about for much of the remainder here. The first thing we notice is that the peak fluxes are occurring under highly, what appear to be highly aerobic conditions. And this is 2009 or 10 data. And it's showing that the peak fluxes occur when the water-filled pore spaces in this coarse-textured soil are generally 30% or less, which we don't think would support any denitrification at all. We found the similar trends in our other experiments, and for example, we measured soil gas concentrations using probes down to 40 centimeters. At the time of peak N2O emissions, the oxygen levels are just about ambient, and the N2O concentrations and fluxes are quite high, again, with a water-filled pore space of about 40%. So we think this is mainly nitrification-driven. The other thing that we're finding fairly consistently, if we look hard enough, we'll find increased levels of nitrite in the soil. And so these data are from some intensive soil sampling that we did over the last couple of years, where we found that anhydrous ammonia band and measured nitrite, which isn't commonly measured in many of these experiments. And you can see it's ranging from 50 to over 200 ppm, close to the band, and in the broadcast urea, generally less than 1 parts per million. So we think, based on previous work, what's happening here is basically a decoupling of the two steps of nitrification. So generally, when you add ammonium-based fertilizer to soil, that ammonium is oxidized to nitrite, and then that nitrite is very quickly oxidized to nitrate by the nitrite oxidizing bacteria. And so if you try to measure nitrite, it's usually there at low levels. But in this case, when we have that concentrated band of ammonia, together with the elevated pH that accompanies that, you end up forming or having higher levels of free ammonia, NH3 present, which is toxic to many organisms, and in particular, those nitrite oxidizing bacteria, based on some old work, are particularly sensitive to free ammonia toxicity. So what this means is they're not able to keep up with the production of nitrite. So that accumulates, and then we know that it will react very rapidly under aerobic conditions to form N2O. And I'll talk a little bit more about that process in a minute. But another thing that's happening is release of dissolved organic carbon from soil organic matter with anhydrous ammonia. So here we see about twice as much DOC in soils from the 10 to 20 centimeter depth that persisted over most of the growing season. And so the elevated pH, again, is playing a role in helping to solubilize this DOC, along with dispersion of organic colloids. We know that can feed denitrification. We also have some results showing that It can promote nitrification-driven N2O. So one thing we're not quite sure about is why we saw higher N2O emissions with that shallow anhydrous ammonia treatment. We do have higher organic matter at depth in that soil. There could have been just more DOC released with the shallower injection, or possibly just more microbial activity, nitrification in the shallower depth. So the other experiment I want to summarize is in the silt loam soil located right on the campus there in St. Paul. The goal here was to isolate the effects of physical placement from chemical formulation. So in this case, we have urea again broadcast and incorporated compared to urea that's banded. So in a subsurface band about 5 centimeters deep, both treatments applied right after emergence at 150 kilograms. Here's the recent data from this year. You can see that large response to the fertilizer event that was much greater in the banded treatment. If you integrate those total emissions, there's a 60% reduction with the broadcast compared to the banded treatment. Again, we're finding nitrite accumulating with the banded urea. Not quite as high. That's at the center of the band, 50 ppm or so at peak. There's been one other study I know of that's looked at this. Recent study by Engel in Montana found a similar trend. So again, decoupling of the two steps of nitrification. An important point here is this is all happening at very high oxygen levels, so there's very little chance for that N2O that's being produced to get reduced to N2, so most, if not all of it, is going to be emitted to the atmosphere. So we think these processes are important, at least under some conditions. Can we accurately model or predict when this is going to happen and what the emissions are going to be? There's really two components to that. The first is predicting when we're going to have nitrite accumulating, at what banding intensity or at what concentration are these effects going to happen. Do they actually happen at lower levels under the broadcast treatment, and is this actually contributing to the emissions with broadcast treatment? The second part of the modeling effort is predicting the emissions when the nitrite concentration is known, which in some ways is easier to do. So that's what we focused on first. We did some laboratory experiments where we added nitrite to soils under aerobic conditions. We actually looked at non-sterile and sterilized soils and found a relatively rapid production of N2O under both conditions. So we think what's happening in terms of processes is so-called chemo-denitrification in the abiotic soils and so-called nitrifier denitrification in the biotic soils, in the unsterile soils. But what we can do with these data is come up with a simple model of N2O production rate, basically a first-order model using the slope of that relationship to predict the N2O production rate as a function of this rate coefficient and the nitrite concentration. So then we focused on the rate coefficient a little bit, looked at how it changes with temperature, changes rather predictably. We can model it using the Arrhenius relationship. We looked at the kinetics in multiple soil samples and found a pretty good relationship. Kp was positively correlated with soil organic matter, dissolved organic carbon, and acidity. So when we started to think about how we would model this, It actually gets quite complicated really quickly. You have a band, so you have vertical and lateral non-uniformity in your concentration of nitrite in the soil. It's not uniformly applied across the field. This is going to lead to a few things that are complicated, including two-dimensional gas diffusion once that gas is produced in that band. So we like to play with these things, and we've developed a model, and here we're not predicting what the nitrite concentration is going to be. We're taking the measured data using interpolation over time and over space to come up with an input concentration, two-dimensional distribution shown there, with the concentration maximum in between the rows. And then we basically spoon-feed that information into our model. So we have a model that accounts for two-dimensional diffusion in that first order N2O production rate term that's going to vary with temperature. And we use numerical techniques to solve this equation with various simplifying assumptions in there. And this is where we stand right now with that, comparing that model to data, in this case, measured with automated chambers 4 times a day. The temporal dynamics are not bad compared to the data. Obviously, in some cases, we're overestimating, other cases, underestimating. We're assuming no N2O is produced from denitrification. There's no reduction of N2O from denitrification. And again, we're not predicting what the nitrite concentration is going to be, which is really the harder part. These dynamics have been known for many decades, that nitrite can show up with anhydrous ammonia or banded urea, but there's really surprisingly little information about allowing us to predict when it's going to happen, to what extent, what the concentrations are going to be, and then making that connection to N2O concentrations. Much of the research over the past few decades is really focused on, is it nitrification derived? Is it denitrification derived? And really have not addressed these particular processes at all. So we're doing some work on this end in terms of process-oriented modeling. In the end, this type of model will probably be useful mainly as a research tool. A more practical model is going to have to be simplified a bit or made more into an emissions factor model that can be more easily applied to particular circumstances. So I'll summarize with a few points. The first implication is that this transient nitrite accumulation can be a very important process driving N2O emissions. And as I just said, we need to do more work to determine when exactly that's going to happen. And also, the majority of data show that banding, whether it's anhydrous ammonia or urea, is going to increase N2O emissions. But the complication here is that other studies have shown that banding can also increase nitrogen use efficiency. And that's why it's used in many cases. It can improve the root access to nitrogen. It decreases soil contact of the soil with the fertilizer. And at least some people propose that it decreases immobilization of nitrogen, decreases volatilization, slows down the overall nitrification process, maybe decreases nitrate leaching. So it raises the question, can we have increased N2O emissions and increased nitrogen use efficiency at the same time? Which throws a little bit of a wrench into some of our thinking on this subject. And surprisingly enough, the data that we just collected actually supports that. So this was quite a surprise to us, that treatment that had the highest N2O emissions also had the greatest nitrogen use efficiency. So again, this is probably counterintuitive, but if you think about it, N2O is really a small percentage of the nitrogen that's applied, and so that's amount in and of itself is really not going to make a large, have a large effect on your overall nitrogen use efficiency. And there may be mechanistic reasons why you have higher nitrogen use efficiency and higher N2O emissions at the same time. So here's the daily flux data again. You can see that even though that nitrogen, a second dose of nitrogen was applied several weeks after planting when presumably that corn was taking up a lot of nitrogen, we still saw that large response of N2O flux. And so there may have actually been, in the data support, there was more nitrogen uptake in that crop. But at the same time, that nitrification, that short-term response, still proceeded and emitted that N2O. So just to prove to myself and to you that I'm not the only crazy person thinking about this, I went into some recent work by Gagnon and colleagues, where they've published two different papers, one dealing with just the agronomic data and one the N2O emissions data. So I took both those papers and put them together, and I found a positive correlation between N2O emissions and nitrogen use efficiency, which is the opposite of what we'd expect here, and consistent with what I just talked about. But of course, improving nitrogen use efficiency is absolutely important. In all cases, as Cliff mentioned, it's going to help to reduce indirect emissions and other environmental impacts of reactive nitrogen. And in some cases, it may decrease direct N2 emissions as well. But what this is also saying is that we need better understanding of these short-term responses to fertilizer application, these short-term microbial and chemical responses, if we're going to develop improved models and also improved mitigation strategies. So the factors affecting nitrite accumulation, this chemical N2O production process, which, as I said, really hasn't been looked at very much since the 1970s, the work of Stevenson. And some of our data show that it can be responsible for more than 50% of the N2O production under some situations. So I think I'll close it there. Yes, sir.
I'm just wondering if the use of an inhibitor, although we don't see necessarily a yield benefit from it, do you see maybe a reduction in nitrite accumulation, therefore reduction in N2O gas emissions?
The question is, would the use of an inhibitor like a nitrification and or urease inhibitor, I guess combined with banding, be a solution to this problem? And yes, you've anticipated my current experiment. So, and I know this is being done by others. So, Jeff? We actually have not done that. These experiments were all done at the same rate, so that would be, you know, kind of the next level where you would maybe cut back on the fertilizer that you add under a treatment that has higher nitrogen use efficiency, and see what the overall benefit's going to be. That kind of reminds me of another factor here, and that is that all fertilizers are not created equal with respect to their upstream greenhouse gas costs of production. And so, in fact, anhydrous ammonia has slightly, maybe 20% lower, depends on which data you look at, 20% lower upstream costs. So that would actually counteract the higher N2O emissions to a certain extent. But I don't do life cycle analysis, so.
All right.
Any more?
Okay. Thank you, Rod. Let's give him another hand.